Well, it's good to be here. Children, they're all making their way. I appreciate all the people that are helping and involved with that. I'm going to do something. I'm not sure that he will enjoy it, but he's going to do this. Jeff, would you do me a favor? Would you stand up for just a second? I haven't had a chance to properly thank him. Listen, 23 years, is that correct? Is that right, Jeff, 23? 25? I underestimated. The imprint that he left on this community and that he left on this church echoes even beyond and into today. The goodness that I've found among you, the love that I've found among you, and the heart to make Jesus known, that's just the heartbeat of this church. Now, obviously, all of us are, you know, our own people, but I could say for certain that much of who we are, as who you are in Christ, is because God used this man. And I am super thankful and appreciative of Jeff, his friendship, his prayer for me, and super grateful that God used him in an incredibly powerful way. And man, just thank you, Jeff. I mean that. I don't know if that's... Thanks, man. Thanks. I'm guessing he'd probably be the last person to want that to happen, but I felt that it was absolutely 100% appropriate. And I say this as well, behind every good man is an even better woman. Patty, thank you for all the... and so I'm grateful. I'm very, very grateful. I'm very thankful to... And thank you, Jeff, for leading. My music ability is beyond terrible. And so I've been told I'm tone deaf. I've been told that I can play the air guitar and I can sing in the shower. But other than that, I'm really not good. So I'm super grateful for the talent and the ability and the heart just to lead and to serve, and for all of you all as well. I don't want to just, but anyway, thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Patty. Really, I really appreciate it. We've been looking at Old Testament passages, just kind of snapshots, if you will. This idea of vintage, this idea of kind of, we have a tendency sometimes to think of like, man, this was a long time ago, and this happened, you know, this was a different group of people, particularly the Israelites, and how does it still apply to us? And so we've been looking, we looked at the sin of Achan and how that kept the Israelites from being able to move forward as far as being able to take the city of Ai, and how basically sin, that it boils over, and it doesn't just affect us, it affects the people around us, it affects our family, it affects the church. And the call to repentance is very clear. We looked at Noah's ark and the fact that Noah built this ark, and the call that God says that faithfulness today prepares us for the unknown of tomorrow. And this picture of Noah day by day, you know, week by week, going out and building this ark is a call for you and for me to use the gifts and the talents and the abilities that God has given us and to be faithful, to be found faithful. And then we talked about how the ark was God's rescue plan in the immediate for the people as the flood waters rose. And then we looked forward, if you will, to God's ultimate rescue plan found in Jesus. And this morning I want to introduce you to, and I know obviously you guys know the Bible probably even better than me, but two brothers. And as an only child, this is an interesting passage because I did not grow up with a brother or a sister, but my mom is one of 10 kids, and so my mom could understand this well. If you have brothers and sisters, I have 3 children, and oftentimes they love each other 1 minute, and then the next minute they're ready to almost fight and scream and yell at one another. In fact, Kaysen is super, super sweet. He might be the most kind, tender-hearted kid that I've ever seen. I'm sure there are others, but I think I'm just going to say he's going to win today. But then I have two others, Brinley and Easton. And I feel like at times they're almost like the exact same version of each other, just separated by a few years. They're stubborn. They're always convinced that they are right. They're always, at times, they can be very much, it's my way or the highway. Brinley wants to be the queen. Easton wants to be the king. And when those two mix, chaos oftentimes erupts. We're going to see these two brothers, Jacob and Esau, and we're going to see this strife and this chaos and this struggle erupt. We're going to see how it affects them even before they're born. We're going to see how it affects them even after they're born. And then we're going to see kind of this just culmination or this big moment when Esau sells his birthright. So if you have your Bibles, we're going to be in Genesis chapter 25. If not, it'll be on the screen. I know you have phones too. That's great. But beginning in verse 19, it says these words. This is the account of the family line of Abraham's son Isaac. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean from Paddan Aram, and sister of Laban, the Aramean. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was childless. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies struggled each with another and inside her and said, "Why?" She said, "Why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. Verse 23, the Lord said to her, "There are two nations in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger." When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first came out, was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment. So they named him Esau. After this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel. So he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. The boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was content to stay at home among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once, when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came in from the open country famished. He said to Jacob, "Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished." That's why he was called Edom. Edom means red. Jacob replied, "First, sell me your birthright." "Look, I'm about to die," Esau said. "What good is the birthright to me?" But Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and drank, and then he got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright. So these two brothers, first off, we're introduced. There's Isaac, and there's Rebekah. And they're married, and they're together, and for a long period of time, Rebekah was childless. And it says Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife, and it says then his wife Rebekah became pregnant, not with just one baby, but with two. And then my translation says in verse 22, the babies jostled with each other. That's not a word we use very often. Like, what is the word jostled? This idea of struggle, the Hebrew word, can kind of be transliterated or translated ratsats. It kind of just implies this idea of this in struggle, this back and forth. Maybe the best way to kind of describe this jostling or this struggle is imagine how the San Antonio Spurs guarded SGA. Does that make sense? This pushing and pulling and back and forth and being physical. There, and immediately there's already this internal conflict and the babies aren't even born yet. It said they jostled or they struggled with one another. This word is used a lot in the Old Testament. It's almost always absolutely speaking of something negative. It speaks of the struggle. It speaks of being crushed. It speaks of being beaten down. It speaks of being oppressed. It speaks of the strife. It speaks of this just internal, like in you and me, this kind of like back and forth, this idea of like we want to do good, but we don't. We want to honor God, but we don't. There's this internal strife, this struggling, this jostling that is going on. And we see that with these two brothers even before they are born. And then we see it after they're born. Esau's born first, and it describes him as hairy, which is kind of an interesting way to describe, a baby boy. But anyway, and then it says his brother Jacob comes out, and how is his brother? It's trying to grasping Esau's heel. Again, you see this kind of strife or this struggle. As the boys grew up, one is out in the woods hunting. He's a skilled hunter. He likes to be out and among nature. And the other one decides he wants to stay at home. We're even described as that the dad loves one more than the other and the mom loves one more than the other. There's this conflict, this strife, this jostling that's going on. And then all of this back and forth, it culminates with Esau coming back. And he's so hungry in his mind, he thinks he's going to die. so hungry that, remember, this strife, this back and forth, this struggle, Jacob tricks him and deceives him. And he says, you can have some of my stew, which, I mean, I don't know, like some red lentils and, I mean, it's not like a steak and like baked potato, but anyway. And he says, yeah, I'll give you some food, but you've got to give me your birthright. You've got to sign over basically your inheritance. Let's back up just a little bit. If you were living in Israel and you were the firstborn son, you received basically a double blessing or a double portion of the inheritance. And the idea was is that you were supposed to be the one to kind of carry the banner or the reputation for the family. You were the one who the dad would look to you as the one who was going to carry on the lineage and the traditions and all of the things of the family. And so as a result, you were born first and you received what was considered a double blessing. And so the inheritance that Esau would have received from his father would have been greater. Would have been larger. The responsibilities of being first would have been greater. Esau, I mean, was to be at the front. Jacob could just kind of stay in the background, if you will. And so Esau says, what's my birthright? What does that mean? If I'm going to die because I'm so hungry, you know, I'm so hungry I could eat a horse. I'm so tired. I'm so famished. Give me that. Sure, you can have my birthright. And so the oath is made and the decision is made. And now Esau sells his birthright to Jacob. Jacob tricks his brother. And it says at the end of this section, it says, and so Esau despised his birthright. This constant strife and back and forth. Now, we could chase down, and I'm not going to today, Jacob and how God used him and Edom and what that means all the way through scripture. And there's absolutely lots we could go down that path. But what I want to do this morning is I kind of want to just look at this back and forth. First off, this kind of conflict that emerges. And this conflict between these two brothers becomes a really big deal. And it characterizes literally every area of their life. It spills over into their family, and it causes Esau and Jacob both to make ridiculously silly decisions. To try to deceive his brother, to try to trade something which would be long-term in his inheritance for something that is simple and immediate. And all of the conflict and all of the turmoil and all of the chaos just characterizes their life. And I think rather than pointing the finger and say, you silly Jacob, you silly Esau, I think what I want to do is to ask this question, can you and I see some struggle maybe in your own life? Some conflict, if you will. Maybe it looks like that there are people in your family where it's like oil and water, we don't mix. Maybe there is tension that exists amongst people, even in this room this morning, where you came to church this morning and you go through all of the motions, you sing all of the songs, you pray all of the prayers, you do all of the things that's expected as you, as someone who follows Jesus, and yet there's some jostling and there's some struggle, there's some strife, there's some conflict that exists. So much so that maybe you're sitting over here and they're sitting over there. Or maybe someone, maybe it goes even a little further. Maybe this conflict has become such a problem that what's happened is one or both parties have decided that they no longer want to be a part of what God is doing in this place. Sometimes the conflict can be in other relationships, but sometimes this conflict, I think, can be internally as well. You know, working with students and working with in churches and just being around other Christians, oftentimes we can be very restless. We can be very conflicted. We can find ourselves in situations where, you know, our heart is wanting to honor God, but yet sin has a stranglehold on our life, where we want to place God first and we want to give everything we have to Him and we want Him to be the center of our lives, and yet there's certain areas and certain places where we say, nope, I'm still the boss, I'm still in control, I still want to call the shots. And we see this internal jostling or this conflict that emerges not only in relationships, but it can also emerge in our own heart and in our own life. And it can lead us to places where we think things and we do things and we say things that would be completely displeasing to God and can completely wreck not only our own lives personally, but it can wreck the lives of our friends and our families, and it can ultimately wreck the church. And so when you see Jacob and Esau, I think the question we should ask ourselves this morning is, man, I can kind of identify with that. Man, I've said things, I've thought things, I've done things, I've caused strife and conflict, I've made a mess, I've been wronged, I've done the wronging, if that's even a word. I've thought this, I've wanted to honor God, but I'm not. And there's this constant internal conflict. And I think all of us, if we're honest this morning, can see a lot of Jacob and Esau in our own lives. Where the desire is to be in control, where the desire is to get even, where the desire is to be completely unconcerned with the things that are eternal, and we seek after the things that are temporary, when we exchange that which is good and that which is lasting for that which spoils and that which decays. So are we like Jacob and Esau? Is there conflict with others? Is there conflict internally? I'm reminded of a passage, and I'm not going to have you read it this morning, but we're going to kind of go to the idea. It's in the book of Romans. Paul is speaking, and Paul is pretty gut-level honest with what is going on in his own life personally. And he uses the word I a bunch. It's in Romans chapter 7. And he says, I do not understand what I do. For what I want to do, I do not do. And what I hate, this is what I do. And he speaks of this internal struggle. And like, man, in my being, I want to honor God. I want to please him. I want to be centered in him. But I find myself far too often doing the things that I hate and doing the things that would place distance between me and God. That would be things that would basically be, the Bible is very clear about is the idea of sin. And there's this internal struggle that is taking place in Paul's life, and he seems overwhelmed, and he seems like, man, I don't know what I'm going to do. He seems like there's no answer, and there's no way out, and he feels trapped, and he feels like this internal conflict and this internal strife is just going to overwhelm him, and it's going to result in a situation where he's just basically paralyzed, if you will, and he can no longer move forward, and he just seems like he's ready to give up. And I think sometimes what can happen is this, when we're in the battle, if you will, when we're in the mud, if you will, when we're in the situation where there's this struggle that is going on in our life and we become our harshest critic, we become so critical of ourselves where we've wronged someone or someone has wronged us, we can get to the point where you want to say, you know what, we might as well just go home. It's not really worth it anymore. We probably should just give up. The other day, my little boy at Easton, we got him a big boy bike. So he's 3. In his mind, he might as well be 33, you know. And so he got this cool new green bike. And it's, you know, it's got the training wheels. But before that, he had the tricycle. And, man, he had mastered the tricycle. He could go all over and he'd go, you know, and in our house kind of became like a racetrack, if you will. And we'd go all around and he'd bonk into things, including like me. And he'd be, but, I mean, he loved it. And then we saw the bike. And man, he thought the bike was cool. And he got on, and he couldn't do it. He couldn't figure it out. Yeah, the pedals were the same going forward, but the little kid, bigger bike, what happens if you pedal in reverse? You guys have ridden a bike. It's like brakes, right? It's not the handbrake, it's the little kid brake. And so what would happen is he would give up. And he would get so frustrated. He'd kind of get the pedals going. He might go one or two times. And then he'd stop and his feet would go backwards. And next thing you know, he'd be stuck. And after he got stuck, he just wanted to give up. And as he wanted to give up, he got more and more and more frustrated. He grew tired. He grew angry. He was basically, he thought the bike was really cool, but it just was not for him. Paul finds himself in Romans chapter 7, I believe completely overwhelmed, tired, ready to give up, and stuck. But the amazing truth is that's not the end of the story. Jacob and Esau, all of the strife and all of the struggle and all of the jostling and all of the back and forth, that's not the end of the story. If all we were left with was this massive problem where Jacob and Esau fought even before they were born, even as they were little boys, even as they were growing into men, and it culminates with Esau giving up all of the blessings of his inheritance for a little silly bowl of food, and that's where it ends, it'd be tragic. If we look in Romans chapter 7 and we see this internal struggle where we see Paul overwhelmed and ready to give up and ready to say, I'm done, and ready to throw in the towel, raise the white flag, if that's where it ended, that would be so, so, so tragic. But at the end of Romans chapter 7 says, Paul says, who can rescue me? Thanks be to God, because Jesus can and does rescue. Jacob and Esau, thanks be to God that even though there was all of this chaos and all of this strife, we're not going to go there this morning. If you have some time this afternoon, read Genesis 33. There's forgiveness and there's reconciliation. The constant strife that we find ourselves in, the jostling, the struggle that we find ourselves in right now is not the end. God is saying there's something better. The chaos and the internal problem and the conflict and the issues that we have, relationships with others, God says, no, there's something better. This internal conflict where we want to honor God and we find ourselves doing the things that we don't want to do and find ourselves doing things that we hate and we think, who can rescue us? God says, let me tell you something better. Let me tell you of something better. The end is not that we just blow it and that we make mistakes and we find ourselves stuck and incapable. Little by little, what did Easton do? He got back on the bike and he realized something. He realized, man, I can start to turn those pedals. I can start to go quick. And next thing you know, my living room and my dining room is like the Indianapolis 500. And the joy and the excitement and the smile that was on his face when he realized that being stuck wasn't all that there is, there was something greater. You and me, when we understand, yes, there's conflict. Yes, we've been wrong. Yes, we've hurt people. Yes, we've been hurt. Yes, there's this strife. Yes, there's this conflict, this jostling, this back and forth. Yes, we're struggling. But thanks be to God, because Jesus has overcome the world and he can rescue us. And he says, listen, all of the chaos and all of the mud is not the end of the story. Today, you and I, as we've gathered together as the people of God, have a unique opportunity to say this, that all of the conflict and all of the chaos and all of the jostling and all of the strife and all of the struggle is nothing compared to Jesus. There's an old hymn that says this, turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. Who can rescue us when we're in the midst of this jostling, in this chaos, in the midst of this struggle? And we run to Jesus. We look full in his wonderful face because he offers something greater. He offers something better. He says, we're not done. We're just beginning. come to me if you're weary. Come to me if you're heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you, and there you'll find rest for your souls. In a few moments, we're going to have an opportunity of an invitation, opportunity to respond. We're going to have an opportunity for you and I to say yes to whatever it is that God is calling you to do. We're going to have an opportunity for you quietly to pray, for you quietly to sing. And even the invitation, I believe, extends as we come together as the people of God and observe the Lord's Supper. It all points us to Jesus. It all